Proverbs chapter 3, this happens to be one of my very favorite passages. In fact, when somebody asks me to sign their Bible or something like that, I usually put Proverbs 3:5 down as my verse that I like to put there under my name, for whatever that's worth. But this is the context. Proverbs 3, and we'll read verse 1 through 10 tonight. Proverbs 3, 1 through 10. My son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace shall they add to thee. Let not mercy and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck, write them upon the table of thine heart. So shalt thou find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. Be not wise in thine own eyes, fear the Lord, and depart from evil. It shall be health to thy navel, and marrow to thy bones. Honor the Lord with thy substance, and with the first fruits of all thine increase. So shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. Well, we find ourselves in the middle of a long parable tonight that runs all the way from chapter 1, verse 9, down through the end of chapter 9. So it's about a little over eight chapters long. Tonight we're looking at the third section of this that we've turned our attention to. And remember, it is couched in terms of a mother giving advice or counsel to a son. Now the question is, why do you recall why a mother? Why is this a feminine person giving counsel? The word is feminine. Wisdom in Hebrew is a feminine word. Sophia in Greek, same idea. And so it's very natural then, if you're going to personify wisdom, to personify wisdom then as a woman, and in this case, a woman who's giving counsel to a son. Now, we're going to see a little later in verse chapter 4, verse 1, it switches to a father giving counsel to a son. But here, we're still under the figure of a woman. We took notice back in chapter 1, while we're talking about what's going on before this, remember that wisdom in chapter 1, verse 24 says, because I have called and ye refused, I stretched out my hand and no man regarded, but ye have set it not on my counsel, would have none of my reproof, because you wouldn't listen to me. I will then laugh at your calamity, I will mock when your fear comes. In other words, because you didn't listen to me, then when you cry out for me, I'm not going to answer you. And I asked the question at that point, is wisdom mean? Is wisdom legalistic? Well, you didn't do this, so I'm not going to do this. Or is there something in the very nature of wisdom that makes it impossible for this to happen? Do you understand my question? And what I tried to point out is that wisdom, by its very nature, cannot be given instantaneously. It's something that's learned over a period of time. And so by the time you need it, it's too late to get it in the very nature of the thing. For instance, I've said before that usually when we think of wisdom, and I'm thinking of that passage over in James chapter 1, if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who giveth to every man liberally, you know the text. And usually what we really want is not wisdom, we want the right answer. And there's a difference between wisdom and the right answer. Because you can get the right answer sometimes and not know the reason why this is the right answer. Wisdom is all about the reason why it's the right answer. In other words, what wisdom is the ability to come up with the right answer. So what God is offering is not the right answer. He's offering wisdom. Most of the time when we employ that passage out of James 1, we're trying to figure out, do I go here? Do I go there? You know, where's Barry? Do I buy this house or that house, Barry? Barry's in the house buying business right now. Do I marry this girl or that girl? Most of the time, there was only one that would have us, so that cut that choice down pretty sharply. But do you understand what I'm saying? Most of the time, what we're really looking for is an answer. And what God is offering is not so much the answer, it's the wisdom that allows you to come up with the answer. If you have wisdom, then you can arrive at the answer. I mean, go back to Solomon. You remember the thing that got him renowned? The two women, who neither one was of very good repute, who one of them smothered their baby in the night, and they're arguing over whose baby is this. Wisdom, God didn't give him the right answer. He gave him the wisdom whereby he could come up with the right answer. You see how that worked? And so this is all about the process. Let me give you a few other illustrations. If you would like to be a professional athlete, you say, I just want to walk on the field and score the winning touchdown. Or I want to just come out of the stands and hit the winning home run. And if you know anything about athletics, you know it doesn't work that way. You've got to, I'm just thinking, I mean, as small time as the football team I played on, that's about as small time as you can get. 8-man B football in Texas. There was a 6-man, but we were 8-man. Didn't have enough kids for 11-man. And that's about as small time as you'd be. But the idea of somebody going out, coming out off the bench, somebody coming out of the stands, going out on the field in a football game, you'd get slaughtered. Because you realize how long it took for us to get in shape, to be able to get out there and endure the rigors of a football game. And I'm talking small time stuff, not anywhere near like what you'd see in college or pros. In other words, you think of what it takes to be a professional athlete. Lord, I want to be a professional athlete tonight, right? Instantaneously. Or, I want to be a concert pianist. Well, you want to be a concert pianist? I remember my friend, Mac, the best piano player I ever knew, the younger brother, my best friend in high school. And he told me one time, he said, I have these people that they say, can you teach me to play like you play? And they say, but we don't want to do scales, and we don't want to do arpeggios and all that. And he says, they don't realize that that is what allows me to play like I play. All the practice on the scales and all the arpeggios that you have to go through. That's the regimen that you have to endure if you're going to play very well. You get the picture? And so to say, I want to be a concert quality pianist right now. Or some of you coming back from Mexico, you've decided you're going to be fluent in Spanish. I want to be fluent in Spanish today. I want the short course. You know, I went to this Spanish teacher and I sat in on a class and I can't speak any better than I did when I went in there. You understand it doesn't work that way. It's a regimen, a discipline that you have to put yourself under if you're going to learn a foreign language, or if you're going to learn to play like a concert pianist, or if you're going to play ball, football, baseball, like a professional athlete. There's all that training that goes on behind the scenes that is necessary for you to reach that level of performance and perfection. That's wisdom. Wisdom is the discipline. It's the regimen that allows you then to make right decisions. Right decisions is at the end of the process. And so wisdom by its very nature cannot be given to you instantaneously. You can start the process, but it's going to require a lot of work on your part. Well, let's take a look at how that works here in this text. As I've said, what we generally think is wisdom is getting the right answer. And I want you to notice how in each one of the areas that we're talking about tonight, that we're not talking about a specific right thing to do. We're talking in generalities. If you look at the first two verses, wisdom again is calling for the son to pay attention to her, to heed her word, to keep her law, her commandments. And notice the second half of this is the reward that comes from that. And you'll see that we've got little verses. It's almost like verses of a song or a hymn. And the first half tells you what you need to do. The second half is the reward that you get from doing it. Sort of like go to class every day, go to Spanish class, and you come out speaking Spanish. Learn your scales and your arpeggios, and you'll be able to play the piano. It's sort of like, do this, and here is what will then follow. And so we see those first two verses sounds a whole lot like what we've seen in really up to this point. Wisdom crying out, give me your ear, listen to me, take heed to what I'm telling you to do. And notice the things that now follow. And in each case, it's not specific things you do, it's more the character that you are to put on. It's very similar to what I was talking about last Sunday. It's not telling you what to do, it's telling you what to be. Here's what I want you to be. Then what you do will flow naturally out of what you are, if you are the right thing. That makes sense? And let's look at these right things. What is it that wisdom says you need to be? The first one is what I call in verse 3 and 4, fidelity, or perhaps a better word would be faithfulness, fidelity. Notice in verse 3, let not mercy and truth forsake thee. I don't have another version up here. Anybody have an ESV? NIV? Love and faithfulness. I'm sorry? Steadfast love and faithfulness. It's like a faithful friend who will stand by you steadfastly through the things you go through. That you're not a fair weather friend. Y'all know that expression? Not somebody that when the going gets rough, you're on your own. But a steadfast friend, a faithful person in all of your dealings. Now notice, wisdom is not saying, okay, give back the correct change when somebody asks you for change. That would be a specific thing. Instead, what wisdom is expressing is here is what the characteristic, the quality of your character that you're to put on. Faithfulness. That you can be depended on. You can be trusted. You can be relied upon. Notice he talks about putting it around your neck, writing it on the table of your heart. This is what you're to be within. And then here is the reward that's going to fall in verse 4. You're going to find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man. People are going to trust you. People will seek your advice. They're going to look to you. They're going to depend upon you. You're going to show yourself dependable because of your faithfulness. Does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm trying to get across to you? That we're not talking about, okay, if you're going to be wise, here's what you do. That's going to come, but it's going to come as you put on these qualities of your character. And that first one is very important, that you are dependable, you're steadfast, you're not fickle, you're faithful. You can be depended on, you can be relied upon. We used to say your word is your bond. When you say something, your yea means yea and your nay means nay. People know where you stand. They can depend on you. All right, that's the first quality. The second quality, I really need to let y'all do some of the work here. In verses 5 and 6, notice these are all little couplets, like verses of a hymn. The next one is in 5 and 6. What would you say is the quality that you're supposed to put on here? Trusting. What does that mean? Well, it means to be believing. Do you remember that we talked not too long ago, when we were in the Psalms, about all the Old Testament words that are synonyms for believing? Here's one, trusting. That's what it means to trust. You believe in somebody. Can you give me some of the other synonyms that we find in the Old Testament? Wait upon the Lord. That's just another way of saying trusting. What's that? Faith. Well, faith is sort of the umbrella term. Faith is the noun for what believing is. What about, yeah? Well, but the idea of waiting on the Lord is that I am going to look to Him. And by the way, this is another one I just gave you, to look to God. He that looks on me, look unto me and be ye saved, is another way of saying trust in the Lord or believe in the Lord. So in this thing, waiting on the Lord is basically saying that I am utterly dependent on God to make the move. I cannot do it myself. There's a whole, yeah, Craig, hearken to the Lord, seek, rest. I like that one. To rest in the Lord. I can give you a few others. To lean on the Lord. To wait, to rest, to look. All of these terms are just different synonyms for what we would call faith. And so notice the second thing that you are to put on is, in other words, faithfulness is how then you come across to other people. But the second thing that we're to put on as a character quality is our trusting, our faith in the Word and the ability of God. Notice the promise that follows that God will then direct thy paths, or more literally, and I think the ESV translates it this way, he will make straight paths for your feet. What do y'all got? Direct your path. That's the King James. Make your paths straight. Now, notice they've translated it direct your paths. In this case, make your paths straight. What does it mean to make your path straight? Okay. In other words, the idea of straight is righteous. It's rectified. You are right. It's like, Jeremy, if you're trying to get a stud vertical, you say a little to the left, a little to the right. That's right. In other words, it lines up. And so in the sense of a straight paths for your feet, that the way is straight, it's right. It doesn't. And what would be the opposite? Crooked. And what would crooked imply? Devious. You know, you have the idea of a serpentine snake. So the idea of crookedness, we talk about somebody being a crook. Well, why do we call them a crook? Because they're crooked. Well, what do we mean they're crooked? It's a synonym for dishonest, isn't it? This guy's a crook. He's crooked. He doesn't do right. So, in other words, here, straight is sort of opposed to crookedness. And what that is implying is that God will then give us a straight path to walk. We will see the right way, and not so much right and wrong as it is right and sinful. I mean, I know sinful is wrong, but, in other words, we're looking at two ways. Okay, now this one is okay, but this is like Sears and Roebuck, good, better, and best, you know. But what this is saying is we will see the way that aligns with the Word of God. If we will lean upon Him, if we'll trust Him, then He will show us what is the correct, the right way. Make sense? All right, let's look at the third one. Verse 7, be not wise in thine own eyes, fear the Lord, and depart from evil. What would you say the quality is here? When we say someone is not to be wise in their own eyes, what's another word for that? Pride is being wise in your own eyes. So this is a quality of humility. So we've had your faithfulness, your steadfastness, as far as your relationships with God and man, your faith in God, and now the third quality that wisdom says you're to put on is this thing we call humility, not being wise in your own eyes. Now, what's the problem with someone who's wise in their own eyes? Unteachable, untrainable, uncorrectable, arrogant. They won't listen. They know better, right? And so if we're saying be not wise in your own eyes, but fear the Lord, notice that expression then shines light on what it means to fear the Lord. It's not to sit there and tremble so much as it is not to be wise in your eyes, but to look to the Lord for His illumination, His direction. It's the opposite. It's to have a humble mindset in the sight of God, and also to depart from evil. Now notice the reward here is you have health to your navel. And I always thought it's nice to have a healthy navel myself. What do you suppose that means? To have health to your navel. Or marrow to your bones. I always worry about my marrow, don't you? I think my marrow must be real heavy or something. That's why I weigh so much. But what are those terms implying? That, in other words, this is not talking about your outer self, that we're not talking about health to your body as we are talking about health to your soul. This is how the inner man stays healthy, is by not being conceited, not being wise in our own eyes. And so notice that all of these things are tied together with, it's a very helpful then to get a feel for what it means to fear the Lord. To fear the Lord means to have an humble mindset and to depart from evil, to do it His way. And the opposite of that would be to be haughty, to be arrogant, and to be wise in your own eyes. And notice that it is healthy to the soul to be humble before our God. And then the last one, verse 9, honor the Lord with thy substance and with the first fruits of all thine increase. What would you, how would you characterize that quality? What'd you say? Generosity. That's the word I've got down here. In other words, be liberal with what God has placed in your hands. Now, it's interesting here that you're to honor the Lord with thy substance. Notice that we are recognizing thereby that it is God to whom we owe our substance. And notice he doesn't say some of your substance, but we are to use all our substance in a God-honoring way. You say, you mean I'm put everything I got in the offering plate on Sunday morning? No, I don't mean that. What I mean is that we recognize that all the substance that I have comes from the Lord. And therefore, I need to honor Him by how I use that substance. Oscar, this is a tangible way. I think maybe we are guilty of not stressing the worship aspect of passing the offering plate, the worshiping aspect of giving. And maybe y'all can talk, we can talk about that or bounce some ideas around. But there is a sense in which putting money in the offering plate ought to be viewed as a way, a tangible way that I'm acknowledging my God and my relationship to my God. This is not just dues, membership fees that I owe, but I am, by putting money in the offering plate, I'm acknowledging the relationship between myself and my God, that He is the one who has prospered me. He's the one who has given me these things. Notice the part that follows, not only with your substance, but He says with the first fruits of your increase. This is the increase of your flocks, your fields, and notice the first fruits. That I am in an act, you do recall that God was supposed to get the first fruits. The first fruits of the barley harvest, the feast of first fruits, the first fruits of the wheat harvest there at Pentecost. That He's to get the first of the harvest as an acknowledgement that this belongs to Him, that it all comes from Him. I am paying rent. Israel was taught, literally, that the land that they were on, although in one sense it was theirs, in another sense it belonged to God, and they owed Him as their sovereign. They owed Him part of the portion, just like we on the old farm back home used to pay shares to the landowner if you rent the land. So God was to get the first fruits of the harvest, and He's to get a tenth. That's the tithe, that's the rent that you owe God in that theocratic system. That's how it worked. And this was an acknowledgement that God is the one from whom the blessing comes, and He is the one who is sovereign over me. Go ahead. There, E.W. Johnson used to put it like this, that in the Old Testament, the sacrifices, the offerings that were brought to the temple was used to support Old Testament institutions. And that in the New Testament, we have the same thing going on. That we're supporting the New Testament institution, the work of the church, the outreach of the gospel in the earth. And you're right, that we're participating. That this is a means by which we're allowed to sort of chip in to the work of God on the earth in a very tangible way. Anybody else see anything? Boy, this is ripe for all kinds of stuff. Yeah, Charles? Mm-hmm. Well, keep in mind that in Old Testament Israel, the tithe functioned much like our income tax. It supported the governmental system of things, which in their case was a theocracy. Now, you have to be somewhat careful. You say, well, we ought to be doing the tithe today just like they did. Well, they had three of them, remember. They had two every year and one every third year. So they wound up giving about 23 1/3% of their income. But keep in mind that that was not only to support, in other words, that was their institution. That was their government. It would function much like our income tax today if we were in a theocracy. The New Testament puts things differently in the sense that everything we have is God's. That's what is being acknowledged here. And that several principles are given by Paul. That's in 2 Corinthians 7 and 8, by the way. What you were seeking for there. And you go back and look at what Paul appeals to. And he does not appeal to the tithe. That's very interesting. Here is a case where he's trying to motivate the saints in Corinth to give an offering. Now, this is a special offering to help some of the poor folks back in Jerusalem. And there's about three different ways, maybe more than that, but I can think of three. Number one, he holds up the Macedonians and says, those folks up there, they just gave so much, I'm afraid they gave too much. And you begin to understand, it's sort of like Fernando's egg. Y'all probably hadn't heard about Fernando's egg down in Mexico, but he had this huge egg that had two other eggs inside it. It's a strange looking thing. Great big thing. And I'm thinking about the old story about the rooster that found the ostrich egg and told the hens in the hen house. I'm not complaining. I just want to show you what other folks are doing. Fernando had this triple egg thing going on here. And I can just sort of imagine, you know, I just want to show you what other folks are doing. Well, that's exactly what Paul's doing. He's holding up the example of the Macedonians up here. Look what they did. And so these Corinthians down in southern Greece, you got to say, well, wait a minute, these guys gave that. I need to dig deep. And then he talks about that a farmer, who, if he sows little, he reaps little. Now, just because you sow a lot doesn't mean you're going to reap a lot. I can tell you many tales about that. But I do know this, if you don't sow much, you're not going to reap much. That's true. And so, in the very law of nature, the more you sow, the more you reap. And so, Paul is talking about that you reap more if you sow more, and he's talking about giving. Now, I don't believe he means that we necessarily reap in kind. If I put money in the plate, doesn't mean I'm going to get money back. But we will be blessed by sowing. And we may not be blessed not only not in kind, but in time. It may be that we're laying up treasures in heaven, which really is what we're supposed to be doing anyway. But nevertheless, Paul does resort to that principle that the more you give, the more you get. And then thirdly, he motivates by saying, remember Jesus, how he was rich, he became poor for your sakes, that you through his poverty might be made rich. And I think that's the trump card here. If that doesn't motivate us to want to give, then nothing will. In other words, Christ himself gave everything on our behalf. He became poor for us that we might be made rich. And so we have that those different motivations. Now, the one thing he never appeals to is the tithe. That's very interesting. Yes, sir. Yeah, and tangible. Right. That's true. You need to keep the covenantal setting in mind here. And that then comes into play with this last verse, verse 10, so shall thy barns be filled with plenty and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. the Old Covenant was a very much legalistic tit-for-tat system, and not only was a reward given, but it was given immediately, and it was given tangibly. And notice both of these refer to that. Your barns are going to be bursting forth. Your wine going to be overflowing. So, but, I would say as a general principle, what is that telling us in the new covenant? Maybe you don't have a barn. Maybe you don't have any new wine. What is that telling me in my setting? And it's essentially this, that God is never going to let us be the loser. He will always bless us far above anything we can possibly do for Him. Whatever we sacrifice, and that's Jesus' words. Whatever you give up for my sake and the gospel's sake, you'll get 100 more in this life and in the life to come, eternal life. And again, that doesn't always work out in kind, but blessing to that extent, yes. And so this is teaching us this principle of the blessedness of giving. We quote that. It is more blessed to give than to receive. Is that true? Has to be. That, by the way, that is the one thing that Paul adds to the words of Jesus. You want to look in a red letter Bible. All the red letter stuff is back there, you know, in the Gospels or in the first part of Acts. And then Paul adds that one, that the Lord said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. That's in red. It's interesting that here is something Paul is adding to what we know of the words of Jesus himself. And that's an interesting statement. Do we really believe that? If I really did, I'd be a bigger giver. So, you're exactly right. Yes. And that's the difference between wisdom saying, put a dollar in the offering plate, and saying, be generous. Honor God with what you have, with the first fruits of your increase. There's a principle. This is not specific acts. It is a general lifestyle, as you're saying, Oscar. There's many, many ways to be generous outside of what we put in the offering plate on Sunday morning. We may be generous with our time, with our energy. It may not be anything tangible, but that we are generous as a character trait. Paige?
Yeah.
Well, you can see here that there's a heart thing going on. That all of these things, this is roughly the Old Testament equivalent of what we call in the New Testament, the Beatitudes. Be these things. Not do these specific things, but be these things, and the doing will sort itself out. And notice that's the way wisdom works. Now, if I'm a parent, I may tell my child, put a dollar in the offering plate. Right? I may give them a specific thing to do or go over there and say you're sorry and apologize. But I have to remember that all of this is part of, it's like calisthenics in football. Being good at calisthenics doesn't make you a good football player, but it sure helps if you're playing football. It is the things that you have to do to learn the general principle. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. I liken this back to the athlete. I remember talking to Mike Argabright. He's pastor at a church in West Virginia. And Mike played football for Fairmont State University in West Virginia, was drafted by the Dallas Cowboys, went to training camp. And they found a birth defect in his back that disqualified him. They cut him. He never got to ever even go to try out, you know. But he got drafted by the Dallas Cowboys. That in itself is quite an achievement. But anyway, talking to Mike, he said the funny thing that happened, he said it was about midway in his senior year that he said, I don't know what happened, but all of the practice, all of the training suddenly clicked. And he said it was like suddenly I understood the game. I saw the whole field. He said it's like the game moved at half speed. In other words, he got it. all of the do's, do this, do that, suddenly clicked. And that's what we're hoping for with our kids, with ourselves, that sometimes we have to do the calisthenics to get to that point. And I keep telling my kids that, hey, you're under the law. You may not like it, but in my house, you're under the law, and it's going to be done this way, and that you're going to eat your peas, you're going to say thank you, and so forth. And you say, well, that's awful rigoristic. Yes, it is. But the whole point of doing that is to try to instill these character qualities. All right. We'll stop here. Do you understand what I'm saying? That wisdom, we tend to think that it's just being able to come, you know, we just want the right answer. And what wisdom is offering is not the right answer. It's the quality. It's the training that allows you to come up with the right answer. All right. Let's go to prayer. And